Well, if you've got a Bible in front of you, it would be helpful if you had it open. And if you want to open it back up to that passage that we read earlier on. And as I said, tonight I want to consider just three verses. John's Gospel, chapter 19, verses 28 to 30. After this, Jesus, knowing that all things were now accomplished, that the scripture might be fulfilled, said, "I thirst." Now a vessel full of sour wine was sitting there, and they filled a sponge with sour wine, put it on hyssop, and put it to his mouth. So when Jesus had received the sour wine, he said, "It is finished." And bowing his head, he gave up his spirit. These are the last few moments of Jesus' life. These are the last words that John records for us of Jesus' life. Of course, we know, don't we, that Jesus rose again. But these are the last words he says before he dies. And therefore, although all of Jesus' words were significant and important, these are especially interesting to us, aren't they? They come at a time when he's been on a cross. He's been fulfilling the moment for which he was born. And these are the last words that he says. So this evening, we've got 3 points. And the first point is, "I thirst." Verse 28. After this, Jesus, knowing that all things were now accomplished, that the scripture might be fulfilled, said, "I thirst." Now, Jesus ate the Last Supper with his disciples, probably beginning at around about 6 p.m. on Thursday evening. The supper more than likely ended at around about 9 p.m. Now, if we know from the other three Gospels that these words of verse 28 were said at the ninth hour of the day. So these words were said at around 3 o'clock in the afternoon of Friday. Now, we read nowhere in the Gospel accounts that any time during Jesus' interrogation on Thursday night and through into Friday morning, we read nowhere that Jesus was given anything to drink. So as Jesus says these words, it's probably been at least 15 hours since any liquid has passed his lips. And of course, it wasn't 15 hours sitting quietly in a cool room on a comfy sofa, was it? Immediately after the Last Supper, Jesus took his disciples to a place called the Garden of Gethsemane. And he took them there to pray with him. And the Apostle Luke tells us that in the garden, Jesus was in such spiritual and emotional turmoil that his sweat became like great drops of blood falling to the ground. As Jesus prayed in the garden, he was in such agony in his soul, in his spirit, that his sweat fell as blood to the ground. What was going on? Well, Jesus was suffering from a condition called hematohidrosis. It's rare, but it's a condition brought on by severe stress and anxiety. And it causes blood to flow from the sweat glands. This condition makes the skin very tender and very sore. And this condition also causes weakness and dehydration from the blood and sweat loss. So even in the Garden of Gethsemane, on Thursday night, as Jesus is praying, already he's beginning to feel the physical effects of the spiritual turmoil that he's experiencing. But of course, later on in the garden, Jesus allows himself to be arrested. And having been arrested, he experiences a sleepless night. involving several beatings and several interrogations until eventually Pontius Pilate, the Roman governor, in chapter 19, verse 1, we read, has him scourged. A Roman scourging was an awful business. If you think back to any films you might have seen or documentaries you might have seen of the old British Royal Navy, you might remember that one of the punishments they had for a sailor who had done something wrong was that he'd be whipped with the cat of nine tails. The cat of nine tails was a nine little whips together. And if a sailor had done something wrong, they would whip his back as a punishment. Well, of course, the British Navy, they wanted that sailor to be able to go back to work. And therefore, as awful as the punishment was, it wasn't so severe that the man couldn't carry on working afterwards. Well, for a man condemned to death, there was no such concern. And so within a Roman scourging, you would have what was like the cat of nine tails, nine little whips or so. But attached to these whips were pieces of bone and pieces of metal. So that as the man was whipped, lumps of flesh would be torn from his back. One third century historian called Eusebius, he says this, speaking of a Roman scourging, veins were laid bare and the very tissues, muscles and bowels of the victim were open to exposure. So Jesus has been scourged, he's been beaten. And in this condition, beaten, bruised, bleeding, dehydrated, probably suffering some kind of shock, Jesus was then forced to carry his cross to the place of execution. And of course, we can see what kind of a physical state he was in by now. Luke tells us, now as they led him away, they laid hold of a certain man, Simon, a Cyrenian, who was coming from the country. And they laid on him the cross that he might bear it after Jesus. As Jesus is carrying the cross to the place of execution, he's so physically weak by this point, he can't carry it himself. And therefore, this man, Simon, the Cyrenian, was enlisted to help. And then they get to the place of execution. And they lay Jesus on the cross. And they nail him to that cross. And then they lift him up. Now it's 9 o'clock in the morning when Jesus is crucified. And so for 3 hours, from 9 a.m. till midday, Jesus hangs nailed to a cross under the burning, sapping heat of the Middle Eastern sun. But then at midday, everything changes. The sun is blotted out. And the sky turns dark. But that doesn't relieve Jesus' suffering, not even a little bit. In fact, his suffering in that time was worse than at any other point. Because during those 3 hours of darkness, Jesus experienced the most awful realm of hell itself. Yes, he was on a cross outside the walls of Jerusalem, but on that cross, the burning fire of hell was poured out upon him. And so now, as we arrive at verse 28 of John's Gospel, chapter 19, maybe we can understand why, after 15 hours of physical, emotional, and spiritual torment, knowing that his time on the cross was coming to an end, Jesus says, I'm thirsty. What do these words tell us? Well, they tell us, don't they, that Jesus wasn't Superman. Now, I'm sure we all know about Superman, don't we? Clark Kent, he looks human, he acts human, but he's not human. He's from the planet Krypton, and that's why he has a bit of a problem with kryptonite. And although he looks human, although he acts human, he's actually superhuman. He's got X-ray vision, he's got the ability to fly, he's got superhuman strength. He can do anything. But of course, when he's wearing his glasses, you would never know that he's a different guy from anyone else. Well, many people think of Jesus in that way. That somehow he was superhuman. That though he was, almost as though he was God, with a kind of an outer layer of skin. Well, Jesus was God. Jesus is God. Fully God. But the Bible tells us clearly that he was really a man. He was a man, body, soul, and mind. And therefore, he suffered as a man. His suffering was in no way lessened because he was the Son of God. He felt real pain, real tiredness, real hunger, and here, yes, real thirst. But so what? Why does that matter to you and me? Okay, Jesus was a real man. What does that mean for us 2,000 years later? Well, you might remember, on the 24th of June of this year, England lost to Italy on penalties in the Euros. Now, how did we describe that defeat? Well, what did we say? We said, we lost. Or if your name's Paolo or Cittini, you would have said, we won. But the vast majority of us, unfortunately, would have said, we lost. Now, why do we say that? I wasn't playing, neither were you. But we don't say, they lost. We say, we lost. Why is that? Well, it's because those 11 Englishmen, they stood as our representatives. They stood as the representatives of the English nation. And therefore, when they lost, we lost with them. And if they had won, we would have won with them. They were our representatives. But why were they our representatives? And how could they be our representatives? Well, they could only be our representatives because they are like us. They're English. You can't be Spanish and play for England. You can't be Brazilian, as much as we wish that a Brazilian might come and play for England, but you have to be English. Only an Englishman can represent England. Well, likewise, only a man, a real man, can stand as the representative of mankind. So Jesus could only stand as the representative of men and women like you and me because he was a real man. So Jesus is human. Okay. Let's move on to the second thing that Jesus says, though, and the last thing that John records for us. Having said, I thirst, he's given a drink of sour wine or vinegar. And then he says, in verse 30, it is finished. Now that's three words in our English translation, but in the original Greek it's only one. And the word is tetelestai. Now the word tetelestai only appears twice in the New Testament. And we've seen it both times in our reading. Verse 28. After this, Jesus, knowing that all things were now accomplished. That's the word tetelestai. And that's the literal meaning of the word. The word means accomplished. So Jesus had been born and raised with the aim of dying on a cross to take the punishment that sinners deserve. And as he comes to the end of his time on the cross, he says, "It is finished. It's accomplished." But actually, there's another meaning to this word. Receipts from New Testament times have been found, and on those receipts is written this word, tetelestai. Because this word also carries the meaning of a debt being paid. A debt being paid in full. So, your mortgage, is it tetelestai? Well, mine isn't. I still owe the Halifax a fair amount of money. But my in-laws, they paid off their mortgage years ago. So their mortgage is tetelestai. It's paid in full. And here, Jesus cries victoriously, "It is finished." Tetelestai. And with these words, or with this one word, Jesus declares that the debt of sin which was owed has been paid. Now, we said earlier on in our prayer, didn't we, that God is holy and he's good and he's just. And far from being distant and removed, God is concerned about us, and he's concerned about the way we live. He's concerned about the way you live. He's concerned about the fact that you ignore him and disobey him. And he's concerned about the fact that you hurt others and treat others horribly at times. And God, because he's so good and because he's so just, he must, in his justice, punish sin and punish sinners. And yet Jesus was suffering on the cross in the place of sinners. That's why he was experiencing hell on a cross. Not because he had done anything wrong, but because we've done wrong things. Because we've not loved God as we should. Because we've not loved others as we should. Because we've chosen to ignore doing the right things and to choose to do the bad things. Because of all the rotten stuff in our lives. Jesus died not because he was a sinner, but because we're sinners. And on that cross, he experienced the punishment that sinners deserve. And yet here, as his time on the cross is coming to an end, he says, "It's finished. The debt's been paid. The debt's been paid in full." All of the sins of God's people that would carry them to hell have been dealt with at the cross. Now let's just stop there for a minute. Maybe you're here tonight for the first time. Maybe this is your first time in church. Maybe you're wondering what Christianity is all about. And you look at the world and you say, "Well, look, there are thousands of religions in this world, and all of them are claiming to have the truth." So, with all of these religions and seeing kind of Christianity and Jesus as just one of a load of religions, how can I tell them apart? And how can I know which one is right? Well, if I can say to you, friend, these three words, "It is finished," or the one word in the Greek, tetelestai, it differentiates Bible-based Christianity from every other religion on the face of this planet. Let's just have a brief look at a few of the major religions. Think of Judaism. Judaism is filled with thousands upon thousands of laws and rituals written in the Jewish Talmud. And how do you please God? How do you get acceptance with God? It's through keeping the rules and going through the rituals. Well, look at Islam. In Islam, there are five pillars, five kind of rules as to how to live, as well as thousands of hadiths. But if you want to be accepted by God in Islam, what do you need to do? You need to live according to the five pillars. You need to keep the rules and go through the rituals. I mean, look at Hinduism or Sikhism or Buddhism. And all of them teach that if you want to please God or the gods or kind of the force that's in control of this universe, then what you need to do is you need to build up a bank of karma. You need to get karma credit, essentially. Do good things, go through certain rituals, and you'll get some kind of good karma. And that will work for you. What about Roman Catholicism? They say the death of Jesus wasn't enough. No, what you need to do is you need to keep the sacraments. You need to go to confession. You need to go to mass. You need to do this and do that. And only by doing things can you have any hope of God accepting you. Do you see the theme which runs throughout all of these religions and actually all the other religions in this world? Forgiveness of the wrong things in your life, acceptance with God, a home in heaven. It's all based on what you do. And therefore, of course, in any religion, you never find any certainty of forgiveness. You never find any certainty of acceptance with God. You never find any certainty of a home in heaven. Why not? Well, because if it's all based on what you do, how can you ever be sure that you've done enough? In a sense, you could sum up religion by the simple words, try your hardest and hope for the best. And that's all religion can offer. If Jesus said, it is finished, well, religion, what does it say? It says, you're not finished yet. In fact, you're never finished. There's always more to do, and you can never know. You can never know whether you've done enough. And yet Jesus, here, after experiencing hell on a cross, says, it is finished. It's paid in full. The punishment of sin, the debt that is owed to God for the life that we have lived, it's paid in full. And if Jesus has done everything, and if there's nothing more that we can do, then actually the Bible tells us all we need to do is believe. In many ways, it's like jumping out of an aeroplane. If you decide to do a parachute jump, what are you putting your trust in? Well, all of your trust, all of your faith, all of your hope of survival, it's not based on your ability to flap. It's not based on the fact that you've lost a little bit of weight recently, so hopefully you'll be a bit lighter on the way down. All of your trust, all of your faith is wrapped up in that parachute. You know, without that parachute, you can do nothing. Without that parachute, you've got no hope. That parachute is your only hope. And therefore, all of your faith is in that parachute. Well, Jesus Christ said, it is finished. He's done everything that is necessary for sinners, people who are guilty before God, to be forgiven and to have peace with God. And because Jesus has done everything, because it is finished and there's nothing more that we can do, just as we had put faith in a parachute to save us from plummeting to our deaths. So if we want to be saved from our sin, then the Bible tells us we need to put our faith in Jesus Christ, knowing that he's done everything and that we can't do anything to save ourselves. So we come to the final point. Jesus has said, it is finished, in the last sentence of verse 30. And bowing his head, he gave up his spirit. There's one last thing that's got to happen before Jesus' words, it is finished, can get their full stop. Jesus has to die. The wages of sin is death, Paul tells us in the book of Romans. The judgment of God on a rebellious human race is death. And therefore, for the wages of death to be fully paid, Jesus must die. But look how John describes his death. He says, he gave up his spirit. Those words could equally be translated, he dismissed his spirit. Jesus' death wasn't involuntary. It didn't take him by surprise. Jesus dismissed his own soul from his own body. He had complete control over the moment of his death. In fact, in chapter 10 of John's Gospel, he said this, "My Father loves me because I lay down my life, that I may take it again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of myself. I have power to lay it down. I have power to take it again." Jesus was the only one with the authority to end his life. And therefore his final act is to bow his head, dismiss his soul from his body, and to offer his life as a sacrifice for sinners. Okay, so hopefully, by now, we understand to some degree what's gone on the cross. And we understand, at least we understand in some way, why Jesus says what he does. But again, what does that mean for us? What relevance does all this have for you and me living 2,000 years later, thousands of miles from where all this took place? Well, there's much that could be said to you this evening if you're a Christian about having assurance of salvation, knowing that all your past sins, all your present sins have been left at the cross. But this evening, I want to really speak to you here this evening if you're not a Christian. If you're not a Christian, if you've never owned up to the fact that you're a sinner, if you've never confessed your sin to God and asked him to forgive you and asked him to change you, well, then my question would be this evening, my friend, what are you waiting for? Jesus has done everything that was necessary for you tonight to be saved. He doesn't say, become a good person. He doesn't say, come to church enough times and then I'll accept you. He's done everything. And he asks us simply to believe in him. So what are you waiting for? Let's use our imaginations for a moment. What if you were in debt? You were in debt to the tune of hundreds and thousands of pounds. Or maybe even hundreds of thousands of pounds. And you had no way of paying that debt back. And you're about to go home and tell your wife and your kids that you're bankrupt. And that because you're bankrupt, they're now homeless. And at your lowest point, someone writes you a check for the full amount that you're in debt to, and they offer it to you as a gift. What would be your response? Or what if you're on a plane, but the plane that you're traveling is on fire, and it's going down? And in all the screams and in all the panic and in all the smoke, someone offers you a parachute. What's going to be your response? Or what if you're a sinner? And what if with your sin you had offended the God who had made you? And what if in your sin you were guilty before him and therefore condemned to hell? And in that hopeless of all hopeless situations, someone said, I'll take the punishment on your behalf. I'll take all the punishment of hell for you. And I'll set you free from your sin. And you can be at peace with the God who has made you. What would your response be? Well, you might not be in a financial mess, and you might not be on a plane. Well, you're certainly not on a plane right now. But you are a sinner. And that hopeless of all hopeless situations applies to you if you're here tonight and you're not a Christian. You've offended the God who has made you. You've broken his law. You've disobeyed him. And this good God, this good, just, holy God is angry with your sin. He's angry with you for your sin. And because of your sin, you're condemned. You got no chance of pleading not guilty. You are guilty. And you know it, don't you? Your own conscience condemns you. I don't need to stand here tonight and convince you you're a sinner. You know what it is to feel shame and guilt and regret. You know what it is to put your head down on the pillow at night and think, why did I say that? Why did I do that? I regret doing those things so much. You know you're a sinner. And the Bible says that in your sin, you are condemned. And yet here tonight, as we've looked at Jesus Christ dying on a cross, we've seen the most loving act that there ever was. That the God who has made you gave his son. And he willingly gave his life and experienced the punishment of sin. And he did it so that you as a guilty sinner could go free. You as a guilty sinner could be forgiven. If only you had put your trust in him. If you put your trust in Jesus tonight, you can have forgiveness. You can know God as a friend, as a father. You can have peace with him. And you can have a certainty of a home in heaven when your life comes to an end. And there's nothing you can do to earn that. What God asks you tonight to do is to believe in Jesus Christ, to put your trust in Jesus Christ for the forgiveness of your sins. So what will be your response?